Enterprise Linux Security is brought to you by TuxCare, a company that helps you modernize your Linux security. Definitely check out TuxCare to see how they can help you automate Linux patching while minimizing downtime, staying compliant, and ensuring business continuity. Check them out at TuxCare.com. Hello, and welcome back to Enterprise Linux Security. As always, I'm Jay, and I'm here with my good friend, Zhao. How you doing?
All good, as always. A pleasure being here with you. Some interesting stories for you today. Some developing stories. Actually had updates in like the last hour before we started recording. So you don't want to miss today's episode. It will definitely be interesting. But we're going to start with the story from the other side of the road. We're going to be talking about Microsoft.
And we're going to be recalling a story that we talked about before, Windows Recall. And you might be wondering, what does that have to do with Linux? We'll get to that. But as a quick recap of Recall, and our other story is quite large, so we're going to try to keep this one short. But the idea being, you know, apparently everybody forgets what they do any given minute while they use their computer. So Microsoft comes to the rescue with this feature called Recall, where they're going to be, you know, saving screenshots of your activity. So if you could, you know, wonder what you were doing an hour ago or a couple of days ago at 6 o'clock, you could find screenshots. Oh, yeah, I was looking at Bitwarden and have this password and clear. Okay, I'll get to that part in a minute. But the idea being that, you know, you could have a series of screenshots as kind of like a journal of your computer usage. And this isn't new. This is something we talked about a while ago. Actually, I think everyone talked about this as it being the bad idea that it is, because it's a security nightmare with screenshots of God knows what. I mean, like I mentioned, I alluded to with Bitwarden. I mean, imagine you click that eyeball icon on Bitwarden to get a, you know, to see what your password is as a reminder. And if Recall happens to take a screenshot at that exact moment, then your passwords are there, or your emails are there. You could be having a private conversation with someone via Gmail, and then all of a sudden, you know, there's a screenshot of it, which isn't really a bad thing if everything stays local, but, you know, we're talking about security here. And due to security concerns, especially considering what would happen if threat actors got into your system and downloaded all of these screenshots, it just created a firestorm online with people, rightfully so, criticizing this. And then Microsoft, the story then ended with Microsoft saying, okay, we give up. We're suspending this. We're not going to do this. But even back then, I was thinking, you know, in air quotes, for now, it's suspended for now. And when Zhao told me about this, I was not surprised at all that apparently it's making a comeback. And this time, their answer to the security concerns is simply, well, it's opt-in. You have to opt-in. It's not going to be by default.
There are so many layers to this, and we really don't have the time to properly go through it. But anyhow, Recall started as one of those features that Microsoft decided that everybody has to love and everybody has to use, and it's really great, even though nobody asked for it. And it came just after they heavily invested in OpenAI. So it was at the time when they were trying to justify that AI investment. So they decided that everything needs AI, including your computing activity that has no connection to AI at all. This is also one of the selling points that they're using for their Copilot equipment, their Copilot hardware, the NPU chips that now are on every single piece of hardware that Microsoft is selling. And don't get me wrong, those Surface devices, they're pretty good pieces of hardware. I have one from a few years ago, and it's really amazing. But they're trying to shoehorn Copilot, and in this case, Recall on everything, and that was a problem. Lots of privacy concerns. It could be taking screenshots of stuff that you really didn't want to keep, or that made no sense, or you just accidentally click on a link, and now it's on your history. It was really bad. So the backlash was so much that Microsoft did a 180 on that and decided to work on the feature and further improve security measures, because it wasn't really that secure. It was just storing files on disk, basically in a secure enclave that every administrator on the system had access to. If you had your computer on the network at work, for example, then the domain admins had access to that. All kinds of nice stuff. So The changes that they made right now, they improved the security aspect of it. They're not keeping screenshots of certain windows, even though they obviously don't know about all the browsers, for example. So they will still screenshot if you're using a out of a not so common browser, for example. And for them, not so common might just be Firefox, for example. But anyhow, the security concern here is not so much about Microsoft users that want to use Recall, because at least now they know that they have to opt in and enable it, and they should know what they're getting themselves into. But it also concerns you as a Linux user and somebody that will never touch a Microsoft product in your life, as I know there are many out there. If you communicate with somebody that's using a computer that's running a Recall, if you send private information to that person, if you send an email, if you send a file with pictures or medical history or other type of sensitive information, it will get screenshotted by Recall. It will get indexed by Recall on that computer.
Right.
And while it's supposed to happen locally, I mean, it's AI. Most of the AI work happens in the cloud. I'm sure at some point in time there will be some information that gets sent back to Microsoft. The information, as soon as it exists and as soon as it's stored somewhere, it becomes a prize for some actors.
And the last thing that I'll mention on this story is why I feel like opt-in doesn't matter. I mean, for some people, they might think that's fair. Well, I'm just not going to opt into this. And like you said, if you opt out, if you are a Windows user, someone else that's a Windows user might opt in and your conversations might be on their screen. But Microsoft has been known to be belligerent about this. Opt-in to Microsoft means they're going to bother you every 5 minutes with a pop-up that comes up on your screen saying you're missing out. You should turn this on. You're missing out. You should turn this on. I mean, this is a company that will, if you go to download Google Chrome for Microsoft Edge, it's going to come up with a little banner. And I saw this on Reddit the other day. Someone posted this that says something along the lines of, you're already using the best browser. It's trying to stop you from trying to use another browser. And worse, in the past, when Windows 10 was brand new, famously, Microsoft had a prompt that came up that recommended that you upgrade to it. And both the yes and the no boxes were yes. Okay, so opt-in means absolutely nothing when it comes to Microsoft, and this feature just needs to die. I mean, it's a privacy nightmare. It's going to be a policy nightmare, because then you have companies that might have to check that other companies that they're doing business with, their users have it disabled. And if we have something like this, then we might have a world where a company says, we need you to install this utility on your computer to check for the presence of Microsoft Recall before we can send you an invoice. I mean, it's just a terrible idea. And, you know, Microsoft just needs to use, I mean, they need to use their AI for something better. It's like, we have Copilot PCs, we have this AI technology, let's take a bunch of screenshots. That's what we should use it for. And like you said, I haven't heard of anyone asking for anything like this, and the backlash has been huge. And it's surprising to me that Microsoft thinks that the response is going to be any different, but, you know, here we are. As this develops, we'll let you guys know how it's going. As we report today, it's already in the current Microsoft Insider preview build. It's not released for production yet, but if you're using the latest preview build, then you have this.
Or if you're communicating with someone that is. And that question that you just raised about the compliance aspect of it, that's actually pretty relevant. When you have strict laws like GDPR that really concern themselves about the location of where data is stored, if you work at a company and you send somebody else's information about your business or your activity or a copy of an invoice or something like that, and that person uses Recall, then that data gets stored there. That's a problem for compliance. I'm sure Microsoft is really kicking the hornet's nest here, and they're going to be stung by many different things. There are so many ways that this can go wrong that, again, I would hope not, but let's hope it really doesn't make it into production.
Well, if it does, we could rest assured that it's going to be the top target for threat actors.
Absolutely. Okay, speaking of threat actors, yes. Today we have a story that's seething with irony. I mean, this is like the reverse story of most of the ones that we covered last year. We have a leak. We have a leak of about 190,000 messages, not from some company that misplaced their S3 bucket keys, not from some company that accidentally leaked an authentication token somewhere, but from a ransomware group itself called Black Basta. And the way that this works is that this group is large enough that they have 190,000 chat messages covering a period of 1 year, from September 2023 to September 2024. The scope of this is one of those very large groups that operates like an enterprise, and some of these messages, oh boy, we're going to have a field day on this.
Well, yeah, it's amazing. And keep in mind, as we go through the story, we've already reported several times that, you know, threat actors, you know, are usually among a group. I mean, often among a group. And these groups are run by as real companies. They have HR, they have promotion opportunities, you know, they have a play. If you are working with one of these groups and you want to lodge a formal complaint against another employee, there's an avenue for that. And there's different roles, technical roles, non-technical roles. And another aspect we'll get into is the psychological side of this, because as these messages detail, they spend a great deal of time on the psychological aspect, understanding the way people think, gender stereotypes that were used to target people. I mean, there's so much here that I urge everyone to read the article about it, because there's no way we could get to anything or everything, but we definitely will cover the highlights.
The story we're talking about is by Dan Goodin from Ars Technica. You should really take a look. I believe the link will be available next to the to where you're listening to this. But let's take this from the start. So these messages were shared on Telegram and through some download sites. We don't exactly know who the leaker was. It's some anonymous source. But the timing of this release coincided with the time of Black Basta's website on the dark web going off, being offline, being shut down, and it hasn't come back yet. Maybe they're working on improving their security, who knows? They were hacked. So this immediately draws parallels with the story that we covered last year about Conti. What you were talking about, having HR departments, having employee of the month benefits. Man, this stuff is really run like enterprises and not that small at that. So this is a highly structured organization. They have the specialized roles, like you said, they have dedicated teams. They have expertise across multiple domains, including development, infrastructure management, social engineering, negotiation tactics. And one of the things that they really spend time on is on recruitment. Apparently, they had like 500 applicants for phishing, for phone phishing jobs, job opportunities, and they narrowed down the list just to two, which is incredible how they go through 500 interviews just to get that role covered.
Yeah, it's one of the interview questions. Do you have a conscience?
You know, that's one of the things that really bothers me with this story. I'm fascinated by these stories, both the Conti one and this one, that give you a glimpse of how these things work from the inside. Not so much because I like what they're doing, I obviously do not, but some type of morbid fascination, morbid curiosity on how these things operate at this level. And you have to wonder, how do you go to bed that night and think, okay, I did a great job. I did great work today on my job. I work at this fine company and my job is extorting companies and extorting individuals for the money that they have. Today I hacked two hospitals and a clinic somewhere. I just hacked a school and those guys couldn't work for a day or a week, or now they're having to pay me millions of dollars. How do you sleep at night?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, but I don't know if this is going to fit, but I think it does. There was this story on NPR. I really wish I could remember more about it, about two criminals that went to jail. I don't remember what they did. It wasn't hacking, but they were just talking about the process of, you know, when they get started, it's like, you know, they're college students and they say, you know, I'm going to do this for a couple of months just to get some extra money. And then they do that, the money's really good. And then it's like, okay, but I could just work a little bit longer on this and make more money. And then more time passes. And then eventually it becomes really hard to stop. I don't know if that's the case here, but I'd have to think for at least some of these people, once the money starts rolling in, as illegal as it is, there's adrenaline, there's all of these different things. There's addictive personalities that could play a role. Or, I mean, maybe someone's just an a-hole and it's as simple as that. Either way, you're right. There is a morbid fascination because, I mean, this is literally the reason why spy thrillers and, you know, mob TV shows are so popular. People watch TV shows about serial killers. I mean, it is kind of a fascination to see what it's like on the other side. But at the same time, I think a big value for us is knowing what we're up against, knowing how these companies are run, what they're doing, what they're trying, can kind of help us understand in the enterprise what we need to do to stay vigilant, because we have this story here, which is a valuable resource, because if you work in security, you really do need to know how the other side operates, whether you're interested in, you know, the morbid fascination or not. At the very end of the day, you know, we need to protect our servers, and understanding how the inside of an evil corporation works helps us do that better.
I highly doubt that the millions of dollars that they make in ransom actually go to the guys making the calls and making the hacking. Since this is operated like an enterprise, this probably stays more at the top. But again, I'm just digressing here. So yeah, the reason I was going through the 500 applicants that they had for the phone phishing operation is that they apparently screened 500 people and found only two or three competent. And in those messages, we say that they were talking between leaders, apparently, or somebody in some decision-making role in the company or in the enterprise. And one female caller was particularly effective, and I'm quoting, with every fifth call resulting in remote access to victim systems. So that's how they measure success. If you're trying to fish somebody and every fifth call results in remote access, that's highly successful. And they consider that to be highly effective. And if that's the goal for the operation, then one in five is actually a pretty good result, in fact. But it's interesting that they even have metrics to measure success in something like this.
Yeah, I know. It's just like in a call center, someone's measuring, you know, how quickly people answer the phone and how quickly tickets are resolved. You know, they're no different. They're measuring things as well. And like we said, it's a company, an evil, illegitimate company, sure, but it's run as if it was legitimate with the same, you know, trials and tribulations you have at your, you know, current job. They have it too in their little dark sector of the internet.
I mean, these guys were analyzing these types of calls at the psychological level. At some point, they decided that the female callers should be only calling guys and the male callers should be only calling girls or women. And they go to that level of detail. It's not just that calling center in India, to use a stereotype here, and having those guys randomly dial someone until they get the victim. This is highly specialized stuff. They are sure to be improving their processes all the time. So when you see people fall for these types of attacks, it's not just because of personal failure or something gone wrong with the person that falls for it. The attackers on the other side, they're making sure that their attacks are effective. They're not just spraying attacks randomly and hoping for the best. They are really putting the effort into this. So much so that, for example, that story we covered last year about the specific Exim vulnerability, it was early last year, I hope. I'm not making this mistake with time. But there was this vulnerability with Exim. It was a critical vulnerability. It allowed for remote access. There are about 3.5 million Exim deployments accessible on the internet. When these guys found out about it, they were exchanging messages saying that they had to hack pretty quickly. So they became aware of the vulnerability, they were immediately acting upon it, and they knew who their victims were going to be. They were compiling lists of who to attack, and they are keeping their head in the game at all times. They are paying attention to all the vulnerabilities that are coming out. We will be talking about vulnerabilities on a different story further down the episode. So please keep in mind how important this vulnerability tracking is, not just for the good guys when you're trying to do your job and defending your systems, But attackers are also paying attention to this. When we say that you really should be patching your systems really quickly, it's because of things like this. And having a privileged view into the inner workings of these enterprises, it really shows how active these guys are when new vulnerabilities come up and how quickly they start attacking. So if you're taking, and I keep hammering this, if you're taking 1 month to patch new vulnerabilities, that's too long. Your systems will be breached before that. If you're taking longer than a month, then those are no longer your systems. If you're taking weeks, you're just trading luck for security. You really need to be patching sooner than that, as soon as possible. Again, I know there are many reasons why you're not doing that. We at TechScare, we handle that daily. We know exactly the disruption that it causes when you're patching traditionally. We can help you. This is not just me plugging TechScare. We really can help you improve that situation. Not just because we obviously work in that field, but because it's a really and serious concern for everybody. We need to get our system secure faster than what we're doing right now. It really is a problem, and it's not just us talking about it. Attackers like stuff like this shows, this is important. Patching really quickly is very important. These guys were discussing someone approaching them with an offer to sell a new vulnerability that they had found and had not been disclosed yet. The asking price that that individual was asking for that vulnerability was $200,000. These guys thought that it was cheap. Okay, so they were willing to pay more than 200k for one new CVE, one new vulnerability. It wasn't a CVE yet, it hadn't been disclosed yet. So at that time, you were at CVE disclosure date minus how long these guys knew about it. So you're not just patching vulnerabilities as soon as they are disclosed when the CVE comes out. You don't know for how long attackers have had access to it before. Keep that in mind when you're planning about your patching operations and your daily activities.
And update anxiety is a real thing. And I totally get how people feel about this. But and the fact is, updates can sometimes cause problems. It's just the truth. But breaches cause way more problems. And sure, sometimes we have to fix a few things every now and then, especially if you're running Arch Linux. Sorry, I just want to throw that Arch joke out there. But no, seriously, update anxiety is real. And you hear this at pretty much every company. You know, we need to install this update. Oh no, what's it going to break now? You know, because of past history. I totally get it. But regardless of how you feel about it, it's not optional. Patching is not optional. I would be happy to have something break and have to spend time fixing it than to have systems breached and spend months fixing it. That's the difference.
The messages also show the tactics that these guys have and use when they're dealing with victims that don't want to pay the ransomware. They will try to negotiate a lower price. These guys don't really like to do that. They will pressure the victims into paying. They will start releasing stuff to force the victims to pay. These are all tactics that these guys have. It's like their playbook. And these messages just lay it out as they use it. We had access to their entire playbook on this. So you can negotiate a lower price when they ask you for a ransom. You should try to negotiate if you're in that position. As always, and I cannot stress this enough, you should never, ever, ever pay the ransom because you're incentivizing this type of enterprise criminal activity to continue, and you should not do that. Again, the example that I fall back into, unless you just found the cure for cancer and you absolutely have no backup for that information and you got ransomware at that precise moment, that would be probably the only exception where paying the ransom would be less than a bad decision. You should never in under any circumstance fall into this guy's hands and play the ransomware. You're just painting a big target on your back. You will be ransomware again next week or the month after that, and you will fall back into this again. You should never incentivize them. When you try to negotiate with them, when you try to get in touch with these guys, they have an entire work plan on how to handle you. They know how to make you pay. They know the tactics that they need to work to put pressure on you, regardless if you're a large company, an individual, or whatever. It doesn't matter. They have solutions for that. So it's not that you can directly go to them and start a negotiation about it. It doesn't happen like that. It doesn't work like that.
It really doesn't. Even the article mentions something about giving access or allowing the victim to regain access to one critical server as a good faith effort to say, hey, we're okay, guys. We're going to give you access to one of your servers again, just to show you that we can give you access to everything. But even then, you know, you get access to that one server, then you pay it. You still might not get access to anything else. There's no honor among thieves, as we say. I mean, it just like you said, I mean, by paying this, we're literally creating the problem we're trying to solve. And I know it's painful to lose your data, but it's painful for everyone to have to keep dealing with this.
Absolutely. Now, having access to this information, and again, the irony of these guys having been breached and their information being out there in the open like they do to their victims, it's incredible. But this provides you with great information, great intelligence for cybersecurity professionals. Understanding the tactics, understanding the techniques, the procedures that they use, it does give you an insight on how to better protect your networks and how to prepare your employees when they get approached by random strangers asking them for information about their work and how they do their things. This should go into your training manuals. If you get the call that starts their conversation this way or that way and they start asking questions about this or that, you should probably not continue that conversation, or you should inform security that something weird is going on. Go read up the story. If you can dig up the data, it's available online. It's very interesting if you're on a security team to know how the other side operates. It's not often that we have this insight into their workings, their inner workings, and it's always a treasure trove when we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so these are some of my favorite episodes because it's one thing to talk about something from the third person's perspective, but to actually have examples of what it's really like. I mean, that's not an opportunity that we get very often.
And the fact that their website on the dark web is still down might mean one of two things. Like I said, they might just be improving their security. It might have been hacked somehow. They're trying to fix the problem, as everybody does when they have this type of problems. Or it could have been something to do with law enforcement. These guys apparently are based out of Russia. As things are right now, we might not just have had any knowledge of any police action being taken there, again, as the world is right now. It might have been that. It might be the guys that are just restructuring for some reason. I mean, this is a real enterprise at this point, so companies just restructure from time to time. It might be that. What I would like you to keep in mind from this story as we go into the next one is the value that these guys put into new vulnerabilities and the value that these guys give to new vulnerabilities that are not out yet. Keep that in mind. See how valuable these things are. When we say that you need to patch because of this. Attackers are willing to pay enormous amounts of money to have access to ways to get into your system sooner than you can fix them. It's that valuable to them. The final story that we have for this today, and this all happened within the last 24 hours or less, is about the CVE program. It's about the letter that MITRE sent yesterday to their board members. And it's about the CVE program and how MITRE handles it and how it was about to expire today. So MITRE is working under contract to handle the CVE program. That means handling all the CNAs, handling the data that gets exchanged between them, handling the scoring of vulnerabilities and keeping tally of all of the vulnerabilities that come out and propagating that to vendors and for tool vendors, and your security tools that you're using at work probably get data from MITRE directly or from some vendor that gets it from MITRE. So MITRE losing access to this contract would effectively close the CVE program today. Okay, let that sink in. The CVE program, I will try not to get too stressed about this. The CVE program is absolutely not perfect. There's many flaws with it. The kernel team has been a massive pain in the rear side about it. They're trying their best to flood us with CVEs every single day, but as flawed as it is, as bad as the program is, it's what we have. The entire cybersecurity industry is pinned on top of it for the past 25 years. We have no alternative right now that would be able to be put into place on a whim, and much less from yesterday to today. There was no way that we could get an alternative in play. When we have, and this is where the previous story ties into this, when we have enterprises, criminal enterprises, willing to spend enormous amounts of money for vulnerabilities, and you effectively shut out the ability that defenders have to be informed of vulnerabilities, to track vulnerabilities, to know which ones are more critical than others, and you turn that off on a whim, that's a problem, because you're going to be giving the attackers all the margin, all the leverage that they can get, and they will cause harm today or tomorrow. So yesterday we saw that letter come out and everybody panicked about it.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. Like, to think that we talk about CVEs and them getting assigned all the time, and then we wake up one morning and that no longer happens. I mean, that's something that almost did happen. We would have had a completely different podcast depending on how that went.
So things happen more or less like this. Yesterday, this letter came out. MITRE sent the letter yesterday, April 15, as we are recording this. This morning, April 16, very early, a group of CVE board members announced the formation of something called the CVE Foundation. There's a contingency plan to maintain the program independently. Here's why it wouldn't work. It wouldn't be able to go into effect immediately. There would always be a gap. There would always be some period where you would have none of it in play. And then there's all the rest of the other aspects related to governance, related to managing the CNAs, with handling the information flow, with getting systems ready to receive that information and feed it and send it to all the companies that depend on that. It would always be a pain in the rear side to do a switch. A bit later, and we're talking about hours, and this happened like 4 or 5 hours ago at the time of recording, CISA announced that they had executed an option period on the existing contract with MITRE to ensure that there would be no lapse in the critical CVE services. So everybody breathed a bit better at that time. So it was stressful, like 20 hours or 18 hours between the two events. And just in the last hour, we found out that apparently the problem isn't solved. We had like an 11-month reprieve. What that extension does is that kicks the can down the road for 11 months. We didn't solve the problem. We're still depending on MITRE. And for the next 11 months, they're funding. And after that, who knows?
Yeah, it's incredible. And for one jurisdiction to have all the control over a worldwide resource at all is incredible to me. So I could see the benefit of a foundation in that, you know, it could be, you know, standalone and not rely on one government. But, you know, like you said, we have an 11-month window for them to figure this out.
We seem to be dodging bullets a lot lately. We dodged the bullet with the XZ stuff. We dodged the bullet today. We've been dodging bullets every single day for the past few months with all the CVs that have been coming out. But this was massive. If we had lost the CVE project just overnight, the implications for that immediately was to make a mess of all the update projects out there, would make a mess of all the updates that you get on your systems. Nobody would be able to track new vulnerabilities properly. Vendors wouldn't be able to share information with each other. If you have a vulnerability scanner and you're scanning your systems for new flaws that are in them, they would be effectively inefficient for any vulnerability coming out from today forward, because there would be no way to reference that vulnerability. There would be no centralized database where that information was present. So it would be effectively just a doorstopper at that point.
Yeah.
The fact that some board members from MITRE decided to step forward within hours just shows how important this is. But MITRE's letter itself, when they released it yesterday, they have some information on why this was immediately a problem. They said, and I'm quoting, "Deterioration of national vulnerability databases and advisories, not just in the US but globally, tool vendors, would all be affected, incident response operations, and all manner of critical infrastructure. So, you know, they're in the park. So what are the main concerns here? And this problem really shines a light on this. Like you said, should globally essential security infrastructure depend on a single nation funding that can be subject to political pressure and budgetary constraints? Well, obviously the answer is no, as this showcases. This isn't a political discussion at all. This has absolutely zero to do with politics. It should not be dependent on political decisions. The fact that the US have been the benevolent dictator of this project for so long, and it has worked fine so far, doesn't mean that it's a good solution. A change in policy effectively changed this. And I absolutely am not making a political comment about this. This is not about any good or bad will or good decision or bad decision at the political level. I'm not complaining about that, regardless of it having merit or not. I'm not making a judgment call on that. But probably it's not a good idea to have a single country have jurisdiction over this. And we have 11 months to figure out a better solution for it, because in 11 months, we're going to be facing exactly the same problem. Another important question is, how the hell did we just know about this contract expiring after it expired or one day prior to it expiring? There was absolutely zero time to do anything about it.
Right. No, you're exactly right. We shouldn't have this much reliance, like I mentioned too, that one jurisdiction controls all the funding for a project that's used worldwide. And then, you know, system administrators are obviously affected, but that goes without saying. But people at companies that are responsible for policy enforcement, like how do you enforce a policy if you don't have something to reference with that policy? You know, if your policy is all CVEs need to be updated or patched within X number of days, but you don't have CVEs anymore, well, what do you do?
You don't fail any compliance tests.
That's true. Oh boy.
You can't fail if there are no CVEs. No, but really, how fickle this was, how spur of the moment this was, this brings a lot. The problem isn't just about CVEs. DNS is also managed by the US. Are they going to cut funding to the institutions running DNS top-level domains? Because that's another problem. That would be even more massive, because that wouldn't just be about vulnerabilities. That would be the entire internet.
Right.
What if they decide to cut funding to that? I mean, it's the decision that they can make. If they run the systems and they don't want to pay for them, they could decide that. So that's a problem as well. And again, please don't understand this as a political judgment or me making a statement about which side is correct or not. I couldn't care less at this point about this problem. There are merits about having political opinions. That's not for this podcast. This is a problem that touches on your operational activities. This touches on your activities as sysadmins, as cybersecurity professionals, and you should be deadly concerned about this. The CVE project, until it has a proper replacement, and boy, are lots of people trying to kill it. Until it has a proper replacement, we have nothing else to base the entire cybersecurity processes that we use on. If it goes away, everybody's going to be in trouble. Let that sink in. Attackers won't stop. They will still have access to vulnerabilities. We won't be able to track them.
Yeah. And like you said, it's not political at all. It's just about the facts. The fact is, this exists. The fact is, a lot of people reference this, okay? It's used as a guideline, regardless of how good or bad it is. Like you said, it's what we have. And the fact is, it almost lost funding. And if that happens, then there's a lot of people that reference these, whether you're a cybersecurity analyst, a system administrator, IT manager, you make the policies, or you're a software development company that produces software that scans for vulnerabilities to let you know which ones are important to fix. It's just the way it is. Those all use that. And without that, they all have to do something different. And we just don't have anything different. That's what we have. It's just, we dodged a bullet, like you said. It's the case.
And now apparently we have 11 months to figure out a governance model for whatever is going to replace the CVE project or MITRE if MITRE doesn't get this renewed again. So yeah, there's that. There's a ticking clock right now. It has 11 months on the dial, and it's going to be some fun 11 months about this, because right now everybody pays attention and right now everybody is alert about this problem, because nobody was 2 days ago. Nobody knew outside of MITRE directly that MITRE funding was going to be cut or that the contract was going to expire. And now everybody does. So everybody's alert. I at least expect people to start taking action and some companies to step up or some organizations or this foundation, if that's the case, if that's found to be the best alternative. But something has to be done about this, because as we just saw, if this is as fragile as this situation just showed us, then we can't have an entire industry depend on it. It's just not possible to run your business, to run your company on top of this. And this is not your mom and pop shop anymore. Cybersecurity, it's a lot of money. Cybersecurity, it's a lot of jobs, it's a lot of enterprises, it's a lot of livelihood. But on top of that, it also ensures that all the other IT-related stuff continues to operate. That's your critical infrastructure, that's your gas and oil pipelines, that's your supermarket checkout counters that stop working. All of these things rely on cybersecurity. If you kill cybersecurity, as the world is right now, I mean, it's probably the worst possible moment. There is never a good moment to do this, but this is absolutely the possible worst moment when you can have an entire industry like cybersecurity be put into jeopardy by just one single decision.
Now, I'm going to give an opinion, but with a disclaimer. I'm not exactly sure how authoritative an extension is in this case. However, my opinion is they need to treat this as there's no extension and get it fixed. Obviously, there is an extension. It'll keep them running for the 11 months. But, you know, what happens if a month from now, oh, we changed our mind on that extension, right? It's already volatile. I'm not saying that's going to happen. I'm not saying that's likely to happen. And for all I know, the 11-month extension might be completely solid and pan out exactly as 11 months. But when there's doubt cast on something this important, I think everyone involved right now needs to say, we're not waiting 11 months. We're not waiting 1 month. We're going to make plans now. We're going to figure this out. We're going to have a solution. So if the rug is pulled out from underneath their feet again, then they'll be more prepared. And what I hope doesn't happen is, oh, we have 11 months, so we'll figure it out in 9 or something like that, just to have something, someone changes their mind, if that's something that can happen, I don't know. But it's already volatile, and an 11-month extension is a lot better than having a whole podcast of, you know, this has been shut down, what does this mean? Because that would have been our podcast, but thankfully not. But for right now, we really don't know. And sure, they got that extension, but they need to treat it as, you know, as nothing. Just fix it, please. Work on it. Just get this fixed.
And if you're surprised by this story, if you work in cybersecurity and you weren't aware of this story, because it happened within probably less than 24 hours now, this is how fickle the entire industry is. Something that happens in just this amount of time can shut everything down. So keep that in mind. It's really tricky. We need to come up with a better alternative than the CVE program, or we need to move the CVE program under a different leadership or a different governance model, something. But it cannot rely on just one single actor making decisions about it and shutting it down effectively. It really is impossible to maintain like this.
I think you'd agree with me if I say this, that if something does happen, you know, with something as important as this, and it's not a podcast day, I would absolutely want to live stream immediately and talk about it, because this is something of that importance level. If this was to fall over tomorrow, we got a report on it tomorrow. It's just that important. And, you know, in this case, it happened right before a podcast episode, which is good for us because we were going to do one anyway. But it's just that important that this is breaking news in every sense of the word. And we only know what we told you guys so far. Obviously, there's more discussions happening. There's more activity happening that we're not in the same room to know what's going on. But as soon as we know something, we'll make sure you guys know about it.
I mean, the period for the extension was just 11 months, happened less than 1 hour before we started the podcast. So, yeah, this is absolutely happening right now. You need to be on top of this story. You need to pay attention to what's happening, because this will definitely impact what you're doing. This will definitely change the way that you do things. If we decide to move everything over to a different way of tracking vulnerabilities, for example, all the tooling that we have right now has to be adapted. All the projects have to start using the new reporting format, whatever that is. We have to approach vulnerabilities completely differently. If we don't have something like the CVE project, if we don't have something like a centralized way to track vulnerabilities, we'll regress like 30 years in IT before we had CVEs, where every single project had their own identifiers to track vulnerabilities, and you had to know about the project to track the vulnerabilities for them. You had to know about each individual repository for the vulnerability identifiers that they used, and you had to track those. Now, IT has evolved a lot since that time. We now have hundreds of dependencies for every single piece of software. You would have to track vulnerabilities on all of those independently from each other. There is no software out there right now that can do that. There is no established format for that. There is no way to do that, even if you wanted to. So we really need to figure out an alternative. I cannot stress enough how important this is and how everything could have broke immediately if this extension didn't happen. And we only knew about it yesterday. This is the part that really kills me. We only heard about this yesterday.
Yeah, usually we hear about discussions early on and we get to complain about it in IT and release, you know, blog articles about how bad something is, and we have time to do that. We didn't, like no one's had time to do that. And speaking of time, to your point, nobody has time to track all these vulnerabilities. You could hire a team of people at your company and spend all that money. And sure, it's a great thing to hire more people. I'd rather there be a better reason to hire people. You could have a team that tracks vulnerabilities and just the dependencies of your software, and this still wouldn't be enough manpower.
Again, probably too angry to talk more about this. Really important story. Keep an eye out on this. There are breaking news about this every moment. So keep an eye on this, especially if you're in IT, and even more if you're in cybersecurity, but this will definitely touch on every IT role. Thank you everybody who joined. As always, it was a pleasure. Really important episode today. Thank you everybody who joined. Until the next one.
See you next time.